Nikos, how much do you think you're pushing this product down the throat of the customers? Yeah. You know, in a very polite and direct way, because he himself is an entrepreneur and he has done this. So he knew that you have to do it. But the question is, how much are you doing it?
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Nikos, a warm welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and it's also an honor. I've seen a great list of guests and I'm happy to be one of them.
You're about to join them, exactly. You're the co-founder and CEO at Seer Vision, an industry pioneer in AI-driven camera automation software to enable effective hybrid collaboration, such as in corporate boardrooms or lecture halls. Before we talk about your company and how you successfully built it, I want to go back in time to your studies. You did study engineering at the Imperial College in London, and you also studied at the ETH here in Zurich. But originally, you are from Greece. So I just wonder what motivated you to go and study abroad?
It started off with kind of a family influence. So my father studied in the UK at the Imperial College. So I actually followed a very traditional Greek educational system at a school that had two options. You could either do this or you could go into what is called international baccalaureate, where you immediately go somewhere abroad. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my friends were following this path and they were going to go abroad. I followed the Greek traditional system. I was admitted into the Greek university, the National Technical University in Athens. And then I made a side application to Imperial College, only Imperial College, just because I thought, you know, it would be nice to go where my father studied.
Keeping a family tradition. Yeah,
that was the main reason. And I loved London. I had been there with my family as a holiday experience. Mm-hmm. And then when I got admitted, I was extremely excited. I was initially admitted in mechanical engineering in Athens, and I ended up doing electrical engineering in the UK, which completely changed my life. It could have been completely different. So that's how I started off in London. And the university there is great. There's Oxford, there's Cambridge, and there's Imperial College, basically, in the UK for engineering-related things. So I thought I was in the best place in the world at the time. Yeah. Then when years were passing, and if you know anything about Greeks, you would know that they tend to spend time together. In London, there's a very strong Greek community. People coming from the school that I was in, we were hanging out with them all the time. And it started feeling a little bit too familiar somehow, and I wanted a change. Mm-hmm. So I went to my professor at Imperial College, who was supervising kind of the third year of my master's. And I asked him, hey, do we have any opportunities to do things abroad, maybe exchange programs and all that? He said, yeah, there is a university in Switzerland. It's called ETH. I had no idea about this university myself, you know, because of the language. And he said, I spent a year there during my postdoc, great for control, which was the discipline I was focusing on at Imperial College. And it's kind of nice. You can swim in the river. Maybe you will like this as a Greek. And then he said, and there's also the Alps. You can ski. And then I was sold because I even though I'm Greek, I've been skiing in the mountains since I'm four. Nice. So when he said, you know, you can ski there, I remember that actually all my family holidays for skiing were in Switzerland. We would fly to Geneva, go to the Alps. It was always the same. And then I thought, wait a second. So I can be there studying at the university and I could go skiing in the weekends? Yes. So
done deal.
Yeah. So then I'm like, okay, cool. I'll spend some time there. And my plan was to spend 6 months in Switzerland. But then when I came here, I was amazed by the quality of the university. And unfortunately, I had a very bad injury in my knee. So it completely broke down. And I couldn't ski. So the only thing I could do is spend time at the university. And then I realized that it's not just a great, you know, infrastructure and organization and all that, but actually the enablement to the students, PhD students, the laboratories to do things is next to none from what I have seen. And my best friend at the time was studying at MIT, so I was comparing with supposedly the best school in the world. I heard afterwards we call ETH the MIT of Europe. And then I started learning more about ETH and I felt the opposite way, that what have I been doing in the UK, yeah, in this place? ETH is just yeah, one of the best experiences you can have as a student, as a PhD student, I think. And then when I realized this, I applied here for a PhD. Again, because my best friend was in the US, I applied just at MIT and at ETH. And then when I got admitted to do my PhD here, as a continuation of the studies, basically, it just felt very natural and it made sense because the lab was amazing. I got to work with robots very early on because of the enablement that you get with resources and equipment and all that. So, yeah, it made just a lot of sense. And what was started as 6 months became what is now 11 years.
So. I'm really glad that the plan changed.
Yeah.
You mentioned your family's influence or sort of the history of going abroad and studying there. Mm-hmm. Did you also have some role models or inspiration from your family to then eventually become an entrepreneur?
I think it kind of made it the only option for me. I had two generations behind me, people were building their own business. Mm-hmm. And what specifically was different is that, okay, my grandfather had a very traditional type of business. But then the way that I never met my grandfather, but the way that my grandmother would talk about him or my father later, he seemed to be a very passionate person who just loved what he was doing, and he would go everywhere to do it. Even though it was, again, traditional, not technology or anything mm-hmm. completely innovative. It was just traditional business that you run. My uncle took over all these businesses basically and built them up. So he was into this as well. And my father took a different path. He didn't want to work in this. He wanted to invent. So he was one of the first basically software engineers in the country, in Greece, built up the biggest software engineering company in Greece at the time. So I got to experience this, and it's just, I never heard anything like it took me. I reached the age of 30 and having friends who were working at bigger companies to start even hearing about the issues that you have at yeah. places. From my father, I would always hear, you know, the excitement about the work. I would see him working through the nights because he liked it, not because he had to. Mm-hmm. And it kind of felt that that's the only thing that makes sense. You have to have something that makes you passionate.
Absolutely.
And at the end of the PhD, actually, I had a talk with my mentor, who was extremely supportive, actually, to actually do something like a startup. Mm-hmm. And then when we talked about it, kind of said it would be great to become a professor at ETH. This is probably the best place to be a professor at. But it looks like it will take me 15 years of going around the world before I can get there. And I just don't have the patience to do that.
Yeah.
Very, very hard. And everything else seems like a downgrade from being a professor here in Zurich. So it just meant that even though this would be nice and I could invent things and all that, it would be very hard to do. And then it was either taking a job somewhere mm-hmm. or, and that's where it became quite apparent, follow on with one of the projects I was doing during my PhD. So as I said before, I love the resources that ETH has been providing to students. For this reason, during my PhD, I supervised more than 30 projects of students. I would just put out an idea whenever I had one. And then if a student wanted to take it on and do it, we would do it. Nice. So when I finished the PhD, it was like, okay, there's literally 25, they were not always great, but there are 25 options of things we could take further. And so really, when I looked at this, these were things I had worked on, I was passionate about. Going to industry felt like, what is industry? You know, and then becoming an academic was just, the bar was too high. If it wasn't at ETH, I wouldn't be happy. So,
fair point. Yeah. But I love this, that you said, hey, entrepreneurship eventually was the only real career option for you based on the family history. And you mentioned you then continued your postdoc research after your PhD. And I think that's also where you then met your future co-founders, Konrad and Reto.
Yeah.
Was it co-founder love at first sight?
It took a while. It took a while because the postdoc was the time that we tried to wrap up work that was done during my PhD that was related to the idea I wanted to take over and make a startup with. So as I was finishing my PhD, I knew I would go into this direction. Mm-hmm. The postdoc was a necessary time to kind of wrap up this work and then figure out how to put it into a company. No. And so I did have some publications that I had to make in order for this to be complete from a research perspective. And during this time, I started thinking, okay, how would I even go about building the company? And again, we had found the topic that made the most sense out of the topics I was working on at the time. And Reto, who is one of the three co-founders, was the one that was working on this topic. So it kind of, again, it meant, I mean, if we're going to follow this path, then Reto is the best guy to do it with. No. So I still remember an email. It wasn't even a conversation that we had that was very deep. It was like an email saying, hey, I'm thinking of starting this company. Do you want to be the CTO here? and then, you know, it was like he probably was at the same place taking headshots for his CV and thinking, you know what? Why not? Why not give it a shot? I mean, and then Konrad, a little bit later, as we were starting and we were working on this idea, we realized we were both engineers. We know nothing about the industry. We wanted to make cameras intelligent, cameras autonomous. And Konrad was introduced to us by his mentor, who happened to be an employee of ETH. So when he introduced us to Konrad, then suddenly we met a person who was craving for autonomous cameras his whole life. No. And then I think that relationship, that meeting, maybe it was a bit like that, because we both looked at each other with Reto thinking, that's the guy that would understand the business side of it. He was our customer, basically. And for him, we were the inventors, the magical engineers of ETH.
Right. Sounds like the perfect combination.
Yeah, well, if you look back, it was the time that we met was a great time. Mm-hmm. And I think if I look now at the history of the company, we all played our role based on this experience throughout. And we wouldn't have made it through without each one of us at the right time. So you know how it is with co-founders and teams. It's never always smooth. So when you look back, you can see that everybody had to be here for this to work out. Yeah.
I also want to talk about the research. So you have basically been working in the lab for a year before you then created SeerVision in 2016. How do you know when your baby, your research, is actually ready to take its first steps? Because that's a big step, right? To take it out of the lab and say, now we're ready to have the company to start a business with that.
We were lucky that we had started. So we started off with a side project that was very focused on recording lectures at ETH. Mm-hmm. So because of that, we transitioned from, so the project that Reto took over was not anymore a research project, in the sense of, you know, we don't know where we're going. It was rather, we knew what technologies are out there. We're just trying to develop them a bit to implement them for a specific use case. And so when we did that and we saw the results, and ETH was very actually supportive of the whole thing conceptually, because they were like, okay, this is better than the competition. Mm-hmm. Why not do something with it? Yeah. And then we started building a case around it. And it was kind of obvious that this technology had a place in the market. And it wasn't not about research anymore. And, you know, where do you draw the line and you say this is ready? I want to say, though, for the record, that I do think it's never too early. The gap, at least in the discipline that I studied, and I've heard this in other disciplines too, even in psychology, the gap between research, data-driven research, results basically, and practice, what is happening out there, is more than 10 years in many industries. So I cannot believe that anybody's research is too early to bring out of the lab, you know? So
I love that statement. I think that's a good push to everyone working on something. Go out there. It's probably not too early.
I would even double down and say it's very easy, I think. Maybe it sounds a bit arrogant, but it's very easy to find better ways of doing things. Maybe, you know, from a technology perspective or from a product perspective, but actually making a business out of it and making it scale and making it, you know, worth something to someone to pay for, either to acquire the product or the business. That's the hard part. Right. So if you want to make a transformer in a train of SBB work a bit better, I think that's easy. But the logistics around it, that's where the challenge is. So yeah, I'd argue that no research is too early to, you know, because it's not about the idea anymore. It's about
execution.
Yeah, it's about the path and the scalability and the sales and all the other stuff.
I love that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your technology. How was the SeerVision research and then also technology that came out of that revolutionary?
So what we did differently to everybody else is that we took an angle of optimization into the problem of moving cameras. Mm-hmm. So usually intelligent cameras before, I mean, for now, maybe everybody can relate. You unlock your phone with your face. You get cameras to track you when you do video calls. But if you go 15 years ago, intelligent camera or even drones, people today think about drones. You know, everybody tells me, oh, my drone follows me when I ski. Yeah, cool. Yeah. And 15 years ago, there was no such thing. Intelligence for video was the military, the surveillance cameras, stuff like that. No. What we did is we realized that it's one thing to detect into an image that something is happening, which would be a surveillance type of objective. Something weird is happening here. Let's look at it. Or, you know, I found a car on a drone's image or whatever. And it's another thing to then move a camera in a way that is pleasing to whoever is watching the video. So we took an angle of, yeah, we detect what's happening, but then we want to make sure that we predict what the object will do in the image. And knowing the dynamics of the object and the camera, we can actually decide where the camera should go in order for the end result to look nice. Yeah. So that was a completely different spin to automation, because at the time when we, for example, we tested it at lectures, which is a very simple case. You have a lecturer going left and right mm-hmm. on a stage. The systems that were out there were motion activated. So once the motion happens, then the camera moves. Mm-hmm. And no human operator would operate like this. A human operator predicts that the person is moving in this direction yeah. and will move the camera further than they should in order to have leading space to the person. So when we started realizing these nuances and how humans think when they operate a camera, that's what we were trying to replicate. Both the understanding of the scene, which is necessary, computer vision, AI is necessary, but then how do you move a camera? The control engineering behind it. That's a very important thing and a very fundamental element of IP, I'd say, in what we built over the years.
It sounds so simple when you explain it, but this is actually a big step and a big improvement. You're basically bringing the human factor to the technology. You mentioned the lectures at ETH as a use case. What are other use cases that you basically worked with?
In the early days, we of course experimented with everything that we could experiment with almost. In the very, very, very early days, we tried to literally build a camera. Mm-hmm. So at the time, if you remember, the 2014, 15 early days, before ever the company existed, a GoPro camera you would put on your head, you would go skiing, and then you would look at the video, and it was this shaky thing that nobody could use.
Exactly.
2 hours of shaky video. Yeah. So we thought, what if we put a stabilizer that would stabilize the camera, but then you have a stable video that points wherever? Then what if you can actually steer the camera to something interesting? Let's say you're skiing with your friend. What if you can wear a camera on your helmet that would be able to both steer towards your friends who are skiing, but also be stabilized? And we built a prototype. I still have it at the office that would do that. It would actually, you could open up your phone, tap on something. It would actually capture it and track it. So DJI has built these products since then. So it's a very good thing that we didn't go out there trying to do this. We would have been demolished by DJI. But that was the initial kind of prototype that we ever built, actually. Then we went into sports in general. We thought, okay, this was difficult, right? You put a camera on you. We looked at building prototypes. It was extremely expensive to build something that would be production ready. Millions mm-hmm. just to build the first line. That was the time of the Kickstarters that were dropping. If you remember, people would raise, Lily Camera was my favorite one, where they would raise 30 million in a Kickstarter and the company never even was created because the product was not possible to exist, right? It was just a pitch, which was the point of Kickstarter, but that's a different story. People didn't seem to get it. So anyway, we were at that time, we were building this wearable gimbal stuff. Then we went and thought about stationary cameras in sports. Football, NBA, mm-hmm. basketball, basically, tennis, horse riding. We did experiments there. And I have plenty of hours spent in all these places filming and trying to do all this stuff, like understand how you should film it with the experts together and mm-hmm. and translating this into algorithms. So a lot of that. And over time, we started realizing that actually the biggest blocker that we had was that we needed robotics that would move expensive cameras. Because when we went with a human operator, mm-hmm. naturally a human operator is is only employed to operate a camera in a high value event. So we looked at, you know, events like shows and things like this, television, of course, where you would have human operators. And then the stakes are so high that actually automation and what we were doing was, the bar for it was extremely high. We were trying to replicate how a human would move a camera, but we couldn't replicate everything that a human thinks about and understands when they're filming something. Like, there are all these little things when people are having a dialogue that, as a cameraman, you realize what's happening. You can feel the tension. You can go closer to the person. You can get feeling shots. You can then, something is happening in the room. You can go out and capture it. You cannot translate this into algorithms that easily. Mm-hmm. And then it became very, very, very difficult to replicate everything that a cameraman does. So we started focusing at cases where either you do very specific things. So let's say my task is to put a camera on the goalkeeper, and that's all I do all day long.
Yeah.
That would be something that is automizable, if that's a word. Mm-hmm. and basically, we started looking at these specific tasks or PTZ cameras. PTZ cameras was something that we always were, you know, aware that they exist, but it was always a question mark whether we could make them look nice, because they were cheap. They were made for lectures and other things that are fairly, you know, it's not the kind of thing you put a 4K big camera for.
No.
We stayed away from it until we started realizing that, no, there is there are lines of cameras, especially from the big manufacturers, that are good quality sensors, good quality optics, and they can move okay. So then the whole problem of bringing robotics cameras, making an expensive setup, became just a PTZ camera that you put, you mm-hmm. connect to our computer that runs our software, and then you can do a lot of things with such a setup. It is much more scalable. And then we started realizing and finding out that the world, which was, that was during COVID and all that, the world was shifting towards hybrid work.
Mm-hmm.
And meeting equity became a big topic for many companies. How do you make people who are at home feel like they're in the room? How do you make people that are in the room feel like they can use the room in a natural and kind of the way they are used to, basically? And then the task became, PTZ cameras are our cameramen, and the room is the stage, and we have to tell a story to the person who is remote.
Mm-hmm.
And then come all the different little tasks of, I want the camera to follow the person that is moving around, going on a whiteboard. I want the camera to know who to film. That was the collaboration I mentioned to you earlier about audio tracking, for example, using information from microphones to know where is audio coming from, mm-hmm. so that we can point the camera there. And then we started telling stories from the rooms. And that became extremely attractive, because every corporation has thousands of, like, not every, but every corporation has meeting rooms.
Mm-hmm.
The 5 to 10% of meeting rooms are high impact rooms, which means, you know, we do important things there, from board rooms to workshops and all these things. And so you want to put good technology to capture it for the ones that couldn't make it.
Right.
Or connect teams across locations. Like, you have an office in the US, you have an office in Europe, and you want them to collaborate, and you want this experience to be natural somehow from the room. And so now what happened is that once this started coming out, that we were doing it, and we were doing it better than others, using everything we learned from wearable gimbals to sports and football and even cars. We even filmed cars and things like this. When you put all this together, we had a technology that was way, way better than anything else out there.
Yeah.
So then we became an interesting company for many out there.
It seems that, you know, you sort of accidentally launched at the right time with the detour to sports, etc., that helped you to further develop the product. And then COVID hit, which of course you couldn't have known possibly back then in 2016. But the timing was then pretty spot on by accident, sort of.
I do remember talking to many of our investors about this, mm-hmm. the kind of the perseverance across the journey,
yeah.
because everybody knew that what we had was strong technology. That was known since we were two people in a basement. We came from the lab that actually is one of the top in the world in control engineering. So there was no question that what we were building was high quality. It was just a question of finding where the best match for this autonomous cameraman was. And we did a lot of different things. And I think that's what's actually quite strong in Switzerland. People get a chance to try different things. I think at the time I was visiting the US a lot to learn from how things were happening there. there the speed is different. Like you get one chance and then you start another company. You know, the same company changing what it does multiple times, I think that's a little bit more, you know, so fundamentally changed because everybody changes a bit. But
of course,
I think here it's an opportunity that we have. So yeah, so the timing, I think, was also, I sometimes think if we would have started and on day one, we would have wanted to make meetings from high impact spaces in corporate environments automated, we would have failed very, very quickly because nobody was doing that at the time.
Of course.
And if we were to start when the pandemic hit and everybody shifted to hybrid work, we would have started with this task. The product we would have built would have been very similar to what was out there. What we had in our baggage was that, yeah, for 3 years before that, we were actually perfecting a technology for much, much more difficult places. And so what we came with was creating a wow factor to everybody. And it was behaving better than solutions that huge companies were building. And so that was very impressive. And we were lucky. If we had started from scratch after the pandemic or during the pandemic, we wouldn't have been able to do this.
So, but I also imagine for you as a founding team, you know, you tried like sports, etc., but it didn't fully click and work. Why do you still keep going and didn't say, hey, we tried, it's difficult to really replace the cameraman. We just stop the operations and we leave and go and get a job somewhere.
That's a good question. Why not give up? I don't think giving up was ever an option because I think as a group, we like to see things through. I think that's what I realized about this co-founding group, that even when things are tough, we want to push it until there is a resolution. Like and I think what we were good at doing is it was never the issue whether the product would work. It would always show enough proof that the product would work. Mm-hmm. It was what I said earlier. Building the business around it, and when you start seeing the blockers in how the business would be built, then you have to make a decision. Like I think that's where maybe sometimes people make the mistake of thinking you have to be bold as an entrepreneur. Well, sometimes the obstacles are such that you cannot go over them. Like when you build a new wearable gimbal and you have to raise some millions in order to build the first prototype, and then you turn into a person, you know, in the market, basically your market research, and you ask, you buy a GoPro today, it costs you whatever it was at the time, 250 francs. How much would you pay for this one that actually has this ability to do these things? And they go, it's still my toy camera. You know, maybe I pay 300. Yeah. And then you realize that in order to add stabilization, AI, active control of the camera, you can go up $50. And then you look at the economics of building such a device, and it's kind of like it's a cost game. Mm-hmm. We cannot, this $50 basically would be the margin for building all the other stuff.
Of course.
So then you have to stop because this doesn't work anymore, you know, and you could learn this quite early. But you have to first see what the product would look like, to have this conversation, to then decide if you go on or stop. And this takes some time. And every time it was the same, football, NBA, you could see it works.
Yeah.
But then you could see also the problems. And we kept going until things were moving and we could see that the channel, for example, where we ended up, the sales channels were mature in the world. There was a way to sell this. And we could leverage that. We could leverage people whose job was to install it. So a lot of problems that we saw in some of these things that we were trying to do, which in theory, your business canvas exercise should tell you, right? But it's different to actually go and do it, right? You sometimes say, that person will sell it, that person will install it. Yeah, but if you go into the specifics of the industry, then you see how much this is academic and how much it is practical.
Exactly.
So at some point it starts clicking. And I think we never had a point where we didn't have another option. Even now, like I think even if this meeting solution with, as I told you earlier, shifting to inbound, you know, which was a big thing, if this wouldn't have happened, we still had other things to try. It's just a question of time and money, I think, when you have a good technology.
Fair point. And I love this story. I know this is heavily oversimplified, but if you keep trying, eventually the stars can align when your solution, the market, and the timing really align and match, and that's when you start to build traction. So I wonder, when you then found the meeting solution, how did your business model and also the sales look like? Did you sell it directly? Did you work with partners? How did you acquire the customers?
Yeah, that was the other thing, that up until the point where things started working out, like inbound leads and so on, we were pushing a lot. I remember one investor and board member once said, Nikos, how much do you think you're pushing this product down the throat of the customers?
Yeah.
You know, in a very polite and direct way, because he himself is an entrepreneur and he has done this. So he knew that you have to do it. But the question is, how much are you doing it? Mm-hmm. And then we were thinking, yeah, we are doing a lot of campaigns. We are calling people. We are aggressive. We thought that that's how you kickstart it, right? But at some point you have to ask yourself, like if you ask 100 people, why is it not working? And then it's exactly what you said. Like sometimes it's just the people you're talking to are not the right people. The channel to buy it is not there, to support it, to install it. Yeah. And so when the meeting room solution came across, we had specific projects that people were doing where this would fit. And it would fit immediately. They were speccing out the projects. They had plans to install them. They had ways to sell it to the end users. So a channel of integrators basically existed and is very strong across the world in installing these solutions. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, their job is to put it together with other products. Another thing that often happens, at least in the disciplines that I look at, is that it's difficult to build a complete solution from A to Z. So you have to rely to working with other solutions and with other products to build the solution. And then the question is, what are you? Are you building a specific product that somebody will combine with others to make a solution? Or are you ending up building it, the solution for them? So you bring your own product, which you think is your, you know, how you're going to win. But then you have to change it, bring other things to combine it with in order to sell a solution. And then you become an engineering company because you've built a product, but you're not selling that product alone. You're selling all the things around it and the service of tailoring it to the customer. So another thing we saw when we were selling, for example, to event spaces for productions of, you know, things like the Oscars. You know, we were trying to go into these kind of things, theaters, stadiums. This happens a lot. And then there are people who use cameras. So we were saying, here's a camera that would be automated. But the production had so many things in the value chain. This was just one piece. So who exactly offers this one thing? That was not so clear. But in the meeting room, you make an installation and you put everything, the cameras, the microphones, the table buttons, the TVs, all these are connected into one system. And as long as you are able to integrate, then you have your right APIs. Then there is an integrator whose job is to do this. And then suddenly everything works because, you know, there is a buyer, there is a process, there is an installation, there is a support channel. And yeah, it clicks.
Absolutely. And your business model, was it subscription-based as traditional software, or how did you price it?
So one of the challenges that we had is that our software needed hardware that was fairly strong to build, basically to be able to run the software at the right specs. And so we always said that, and we used to say that also with the cameras, that if robotic cameras would be free, this would be great for us because people would have robotic cameras and then we could control them. Yeah. But the burden was always, okay, if you have to spend 5 figures to get a robotic camera, that's why I said PTZs were very important because they brought this down a lot, even to 3 figures. So this kind of investment was a blocker for us. Like people had to have this robotic camera to run our software. And the same thing with a computer. We had to build a server that was economical somehow so that people could run our software. So we ended up selling them the hardware at cost in order to be able to sell a subscription of software on top. Yeah. In some cases, which I think were the more future-looking, because that's where I think this was going anyway, you would put it all together and you would say it's a subscription for a software. The hardware is just something you run it on, like your router at home for the internet. You know, I will replace it for you when there's a new one, if it's necessary. So yeah, and by the way, this is another thing. The business model and how we charge and all that, not the model, but the business, the pricing, let's say, changed multiple times across the journey.
Yeah.
And that was also a necessary part of the journey as well, to go from licensing for some years to subscription based to multi-year subscriptions to hardware enabled software, all these things. So yeah, multiple changes in the model,
part of the journey.
Yeah.
And I wonder, When and how did you figure out that you really hit product market fit? Was there any specific moment or revenue target where you say, hey, now I really feel that we hit it on the spot, we have product market fit?
I think looking back, it was the time that we got inbound leads that were asking the same thing, not people who saw a technology and asked, can I use it to film pandas in the zoo? Because this was happening, right, all the time. But we got inbound requests for the same thing. And in 5 days, that was because of a webinar that we did, we got as many as we had gotten the last month. And then we it kept coming. So every week we would get as many as we had, you know, a few months before. And so we kept building a pipe without really doing work because of the inbound leads that were asking for the same thing. It's just a very different thing. And I think it's a big milestone. Of course, it depends on your business to be able to switch from running around founder sales, pushing people to inbound and people asking you for what you're selling.
Yeah. Fully second that. Absolutely. Yeah. I also want to talk about the different challenge that you had to overcome. You're also building a team. You were growing as a company after hitting product market fit. So how did you sort of attract but also retain your talent for your company?
Over the path, team changes a lot. That's one thing that I didn't expect. It changes because everybody's life is changing. Like you mm-hmm. join a young startup. It's not a journey that you know exactly what will happen for many years. What we try to do, and I think everybody who worked at our company can at least relate to this. We tried to have fun and we tried to make sure that we wanted to go to work. Not that it was easy, because a lot of times you have to put more hours than you have to put in your you know, tank. But basically I was saying this to everybody who joined the company, that the primary thing is that when you wake up in the morning, you want to go to work. No. You actually want to. You want to, because that's, maybe it goes back to what I learned, right? That you have to like what you're doing. There's no other option.
Fully agree.
So that's what we kept doing. And we kept kind of reminding ourselves that we have to take care of ourselves. We also had many policies, but many, let's say, ways that we work together that primarily took care of one another. And I think that's what made some people stay longer than others mm-hmm. That had other plans in their lives. I just want to, as an example, like there's every single person that has worked for Searvision, some did an internship for a couple of months, maybe that's not so much the case, but every single person, if I see them on the street, you know, it would be a very exciting moment to talk about their life and how they're doing. And remember that time. I think looking back must have been one of these times in everybody's career that was fun.
That's
and I think
point.
I think creating this environment made people join and stay. What is always challenging is to grow within a startup. Like you can only grow as much or as long as the startup grows and gives you opportunity to grow. Right. And that's where there is a fine line between I learn how to do things that we as a company don't know how to do. And you learn by being exposed to things. And it's another thing to learn by being exposed to experts that know something very well. As a startup, we had always the challenge that we were not seasoned experts on some topics, so we couldn't provide such a learning experience for some people. So yes, after a couple of years, if you want to grow in a career which is very specific and technical, and our team hasn't grown enough to have a lead who has years and years of experience, and you're not growing to be that leader, or you don't want to because you know there's just so much out there in technology, so you cannot even. Then at times people would just, you know, grow somewhere where they would be mentored. It's hard, I think, as a startup to always be able to mentor your good people because they are your best people. So it's like, how can they be the best and they want to grow? Like you can only grow by taking on other things that you don't know about.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder, just before you sold your company, how did your management team, your organizational structure look like? What were sort of the key roles that you had at that scale?
I think the management team was always five people, basically.
Mm-hmm. What were the roles in these five people?
Yeah, so we would have... It was very product-driven, so three out of five, including myself, are very kind of focused on product. Mm-hmm. We were a product company. And the other two were operations and people, basically. Yeah. So, and I think it makes sense, right? If I look back, maybe, from the side of sales, we were also, I mean, when I talk about product, we also did the sales. So the two co-founders that were in the management team, because not all three of us wanted to manage stuff, mm-hmm. but Konrad and I, who were at the end part of this management team along the way, we also did sales. So it was founder-led, product-minded sales. That was very important to have as a mindset in the management. Then we took care of people as much as we could. We also did, operations the best way we could. And I think in this group, together with the others, I think we did a very good job in focusing on the right things. And always, I'd say, everything that mattered was represented in this conversation. And we knew also how our people thought about stuff. So... yeah, we had several times where we as a group got together and made, it wasn't smooth, it was painful and long hours sometimes to get there, but we got to do several moves along the way that were critical to get here. Yeah.
Fantastic. One of these critical moves happened in June 2023 when you announced the acquisition by the California-based QSYS. Why was that the right decision to sell Seervision?
So every time that we were kind of trying a different segment, let's say, across the history of the company, and we always asked ourselves, how do we scale this? And at the time with the meeting rooms, we had opportunities to market it. That's how we got to inbound leads, by partnering with some vendors. But actually, if you wanted, we started thinking about, before knowing about even QSYS existing at the time, we started thinking about, okay, how do we become the number one, let's say, vendor for these rooms? And then we started building a concept. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is that we then learned about QSYS and we saw that actually they have built that concept and they are, building it up, and they're missing some of the things that we have. We knew that. So we were competing even at some opportunities, mm-hmm. Because we had more capabilities, but not a complete solution. But at the same time, we saw that they had all these things that we were planning on building, not just on the product side, but also on the market side. Like QSYS has a channel that is extremely strong and global, which is extremely important for when you build that type of business in that type of industry. So when we had these conversations, and everything happened extremely quickly, but when we had the first conversation and we sat down and we talked about what the vision is of QSYS and what the vision of Seervision is, we immediately saw that. And the exact, like, people, and I remember still those meetings, like, we were trying to understand what exactly is the challenge. Mm-hmm. Because from a product and mindset and vision perspective, it was complete alignment. So... that's why it felt like, okay, either we're going to become bigger than QSYS, which would have taken us a decade at least, or this kind of partnership would make sense. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the market, they are one of the biggest players. So it's not that you have many other options. And in my opinion, it is the one that is actually modernized in the way that they do things. It is the one growing. It's basically destined to become a market leader. So it made sense.
And how did the process then speed up from there? So you saw, hey, we share the same vision, but at a certain time, you sort of had to kick off really this M&A process, you know, mm-hmm. with like term sheet, due diligence, and eventually closing.
Yeah.
How did that go down?
Again, it was extremely quick. So from the time that we signed the term sheet until we closed the deal, it was, maybe a couple of months, maybe 3 months. So it mm-hmm. was quite quick to do the whole due diligence.
That's fast, yeah.
And I think the reason why it was fast was two. One, there was a clear milestone. We wanted to announce it at a big event of the industry.
Nice. That helps to keep the pressure up, right?
100%. It was very, very important. And the other thing is that the business that we were building was in a very early stage from a commercial side. So the due diligence on that was very light. You couldn't really go deep and see all the different customer. There was no point. It was a very small number compared to the bigger company. So that part was fairly easy to look at. The technology was something that the experts there were building. So they already knew the challenges and they knew what we had done to solve them. So they didn't have to educate themselves on these topics. They already were trying to solve the same problems.
Yeah.
So again, it's about, I mean, in retrospect, again, it's an amazing timing situation where there was a product being built internally that was doing similar things. They knew exactly the challenges. And then they saw a team that had solved these challenges in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately told them about the team, the way that we were working. And once this worked and the product itself was delivering what was the objective, then it was quite easy and everybody wanted to move fast. Then there was no point in looking through all the little details of all the... I mean, of course we did all that, but much faster because there was very big conviction because the fit of the vision, but then the product development itself and the fact that the market, the commercial part was so clear, right? This, the Seer Vision sales process and team and channel was non-existent. So we would just sift everything. We didn't have to rediscover things. We just figured out exactly how to put it in the channel. That was the objective. And it was fairly clear as an objective. And that made the due diligence and the whole process very smooth.
And it was also a very strategic / technology play, right? That was in place here. I wonder who was sort of the driving force behind the acquisition, not only to initiate the first contact, but also to push through the process. Was that more coming from them because they saw the technology that you built is something they absolutely needed? Or was it more coming from your side saying, hey, you know, the competitive situation or whatever the reasons were that you were actually sort of looking for an exit?
I think once we started off, the push was coming mostly from us setting out a plan and at corporate development, putting together an integration pipeline that would also bring you to a return on investment. So the whole point is, okay, we acquired this company. It has a product that is so the product that was being developed, let's say, was behind where we were. So that would give an advantage and we would go to market faster. And that meant immediately that we could translate it to sales. So the goal was, okay, we acquire this company. The faster we bring it to sales, the faster we return the investment. So why wait? So basically the acquisition itself was almost like the logistics. Then it was a question of how quickly can we sell?
Mm-hmm.
And so if they could have done the due diligence in one day and then start selling it, you know, that would have been even better because that would return the investment even faster. So I think from the buyer, there was this intention of moving fast because there was a clear path to sales and value. From our side, I think the biggest reason why we wanted to move fast was that this was creating confusion for our business.
Right.
We were engaging into projects with big customers, with very, very, very well-known companies. And we were basically discussing scaling up things with them, engaging into installations that were directly competing with the buyer in some cases. So then it was a very weird thing where we had this conversation going on and then we have to proceed with these conversations with the customers, but we couldn't really give a clear direction of where our product is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it was striving for clarity, I think, why we wanted this to be quick. The milestone helped that we had, the event that we wanted to announce it in. And then the fact that there was a clear path to value also made it, you know, let's just get to sales. That was the mindset.
Absolutely.
And then at the end, I just want to say this because I think it's extremely important. There is an advisor often, right? An M&A advisor who will be there to make sure that things are handled well, especially on the side of the startup. Usually at the buyers, there is corporate development. They know what to do. But on the side of the startup, if you have a good advisor, then that person can can make sure that the right things are done at the right time. No. We had an excellent advisor who's, yeah.
Who did you work with?
Highly recommended. His name is John. He works for a firm called Menalto Advisors.
He has also been on the show before. Yeah, great guy.
So, yeah. You know John very well. So he was excellent in this process, and he made a lot of things move in the speed that we had agreed to for them to move. So yeah.
Fantastic. And I have to ask, how much did you sell for in the end?
Unfortunately, I cannot say this.
Can you give us a range? Was it like single, double, or triple digit million?
What I can tell you is that at the end, this was something that I would consider a success. Let's put it this way.
Okay, so the investors made money.
Yeah, I think that's what matters, that people are happy. So perfect. People are not pissed.
That's good. And how did you structure the deal? Was it mainly a cash or mainly an equity deal? Because that can also have a big impact on the potential outcome.
Yeah, the details of the deal are also not something I can disclose. But what I can say is that the merits, the match between the SeerVision and QSIS is also very important, that it matches the vision of the company. So the reason why people are now working there and everybody stayed is that the ambition and where we're trying to get to is aligned. And the company, the acquirer, the buyer, has made sure that this aligns for the people who work there. So that was an important part for everyone.
So I assume there's at least some stock part, some equity part in that deal.
It's a private company, so that's not easy to structure. But there is alignment on where we're going, and I think that's what matters. That the goal is one that motivates the team. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I wonder, you know, now that you sold your company, you're of course still on board, as we just heard. But what is next for you? Like, what do you tackle? What are sort of the milestones for you personally?
There are different sides to it, right? Because while building SeerVision, I also built my family at the same time. So there's definitely an element of, you know, how does life look like? Because sometimes when you work very hard on something, you neglect other things. Like, I don't know, you don't do a lot of sports, or you don't take care of your friends or things like that. So there's a big element of catching up for me, which in theory should start now, but it's taking some time to start. But more importantly, when it comes to the career, I think as a first time kind of founder, this success is great, and it helps build for the next steps. But also, it's not that we built a company that was, you know, trading globally, selling everything through like making millions in revenue. So I still have this thirst of building a successful business somehow. So. Yeah. I think this was a good kind of tech type of exit, clearly, because the revenue was fairly small of the company. So I still have this urgency to do that. I think that's why I'm excited to be part of the QSIS team, because that's what we're doing now, right? We're shifting into taking this product global, building the technology further, and then keep building products that go and make, you know, extremely good numbers of revenue. That would be the next immediate step. And then, of course, a different type of success for the company that I'm in. So whatever happens next for the QSIS and the QSC family has to be, for me, a bigger success than what SeerVision was. So I want to just, you know, make sure this happens somehow.
And maybe an IPO, who knows?
Exactly. So if something like this happens in the future of the company, which is definitely not something in the works right now, but if this happens in the future of the company, then I definitely want to be one of the people pushing and
ringing
making
the bell.
It works. Yes, yeah, that would be fun.
Nikos, to wrap up the conversation today, I also have some rapid-fire questions for you. I either give you different options to choose from or a short question, and you have to answer in one sentence.
So, short question in one sentence or rapid-fire where I choose between things?
Exactly. You ready?
Okay.
Switzerland or Greece?
I can't choose. I want to live in Switzerland, work in Switzerland and enjoy Greece. Is that possible?
That's fine. You get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Researcher or entrepreneur?
Entrepreneur. That's
How nice. Many hours of sleep did you get last night?
Seven.
What's a Seer Vision milestone that you're particularly proud of?
There are so many. It's hard to pick one. There are many things that we said, let's do that, and then we did it. I personally loved filming the NBA juniors in Orlando, like being around NBA players that were there. And cool. I love that we were invited by Fox Sports to do that.
Amazing.
That was cool.
Before you mentioned sometimes an entrepreneur's life can take a toll on your life by neglecting friends or sports, etc. Do you have any regrets of your journey?
Yeah, it's hard to have regrets when you are happy with the result.
Fair, yeah.
Maybe some more discipline on how I take care of myself. This is something I would do differently.
Okay.
Because I think that's the kind of thing that you either do it all the time, mm-hmm. and you kind of it becomes part of your routine. You know, thinking that you don't have time to do it because you, what I said before, you neglect it. But I don't think it's because you don't have time. I think it's because you don't have mental capacity. So yeah. I would try to make sure that in my schedule I can take care of some of the things that, you know, over time they build up. And then you have to pay for it when you're older. And I don't want to get there.
Exactly. Nikos, thank you so much for coming on the show. Congrats again on the exit and the great journey. And we're really excited to see what you're working on and building next.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.